Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Greg Benson.
And this is an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup, the critically acclaimed award-winning syrup that helps gringo bartenders better make margaritas, Negronis,
Lou, hold up,
old
are you just
fashions?
This is how you start your podcast.
What?
It's not an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup.
Well, of course it is. I'm just cutting costs by not paying writers to make something new. I'm just using an old script.
You pay writers?
Is that some kind of jab?
No, I'm just saying
What are you saying?
Well, look, we've got this amazing syrup that's made in an ancestral manner, cooked down from the sap of the agave, harvested the way these families would to make pulque. It's a quality product. It deserves a quality presentation.
Yeah, okay, hang on. Ancestral agave syrup is made by real families following traditional methods. Unlike the industrial Blue Weber syrup you get everywhere else, Ancestral is cooked down from agua miel harvested from Salmiana in Hidalgo, Mexico. It is the grade A Vermont maple to the sticky diner syrup you've been using for your cocktails. Ingredients matter, both in how your cocktail tastes and how you treat the earth. Ancestral is better for both. Is that good?
Sure. Or maybe confusing instead of cheesy. Look, just visit ancestralagave.com to learn more and to order your world-class agave syrup today.
And we'll call that a wrap. Catch you next ad, Greg.
Hasta pronto?
Ancestral Agave Syrup. Available online at ancestralagave.org and wherever Greg and Lou were able to coerce store owners into carrying it.
I'm Lou Bang.
And I'm Linda Sullivan.
And this is Agave Road Trip, the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps drink ex-bartenders but understand agave spirits,
and rural Mexico.
You're in trouble.
That sounds about right. You have to middle name me if I'm in trouble. Linda Ann.
Linda Ann.
Then it feels real.
Linda Ann. I love that. Should we start over again? No. Anyway, so We aired the episode that you and I recorded feels like months ago now, but it couldn't possibly be, but just aired a few weeks ago, at least in our timeline. And by the time people hear this, it'll be like a year ago. The episode about mescaleros, why are there so few mescaleros who own their brands?
Yes, right? I remember talking about that.
Yeah, that was a fun one. Everything that I record with you is fun. The things that we don't record, no fun. So,
not at all.
Not at all. So, I got a WhatsApp message from our mutual friend.
I knew it. I knew that's what it was going to be.
Malena Villasusa. What do you think the message said?
She's going to tell me that I was wrong about who owns what.
That is correct. And I promised her, like, I immediately posted as soon as I got her message. Because I cannot afford to lose Malena as a friend, because I love visiting her place so much, and just the best meals in my life have happened in her tasting room. So I can't afford to lose her, so I threw you under the bus.
Perfect.
And I didn't even need to say that much because it was already recorded. Like, it was clear.
I was busted, caught red-handed.
Exactly. But I promised her that we would also record a correction that very explicitly explained... You can't even hold it in. That very explicitly
explicitly explained that Mescal Villasuso is, in fact, owned by the family that produces it.
Exactly how you wanted it to be.
Exactly how I wanted it. All is now right with my world. And once she hears this, she will once again, I assume, welcome me back. And if not, well, you're going to have to find me an alternative.
Welcome me back too, Malena.
But I thought this also gave us a really good excuse to talk about something that I've been sort of, I've been talking about it, you know, in my tastings. And I think I've even brought it up perhaps peripherally in an episode before. But I don't think it's we've ever had an explicit episode about it. And that is that I am pretty sure that at the 1893 World's Fair, where they talk about the debut of tequila, and, you know, tequila had been in the U.S. before that, but this was like the big coming out party, the quinceañera of tequila, my theory is, and it's just a theory, my theory is that it was supposed to be Mezcal de Potosí.
Oh.
Potosí, yeah.
Really?
Okay.
That it was supposed to be, or that it was?
No, that it was supposed to be.
And it got usurped by something else?
By tiny little tequila.
Oh.
Yeah. So here's my theory, right? And it's based on a handful of books that I've read and just my travels around that region of Guanajuato, San Luis Potosí, right? My theory is when you go there and you look at the haciendas and the capacity that they had back in the 1700s.
Oh, yeah, they're enormous.
So, okay, so I want to run a quote that we got from Juan Pedro, right, who's the mezcalero who makes, and Malena's partner, who makes Mezcal Villasuso and makes Lucy Pistolas, right? So I've got a quote from him that I want to run.
Okay, let's hear him.
Okay.
Let's go, JP.
Everything I'm going to say to you, I am not really 100% sure of everything because in the history we lose a lot of data, you know. And so some things you can take it out of books. Some things you take it out of the local people. So it's kind of very difficult to validate all these sayings or even the facts that you find in books, it's not easy to be 100% sure that is what's the actual truth, you know? But anyway, what we are doing is we are trying to pull out this history that is kind of lost in time. This hacienda, this really huge hacienda that we have in about 2 kilometers from here, you find that it's a huge factory over there. Like the ovens are like 50 or 60 tons of agave each oven. And also in talking with people from the region, we have a number of 30 factories, something like those size, you know. So they said, this guy who wrote this book that is called Jaral de Berro y su Marquesado says that this hacienda, just this one hacienda in here, with the name of the factory was named La Soledad, it was really big and it sells vino mezcal from many places on the Mexican Republic, you know?
What's the Mexican Republic?
Basically, he means in Mexico.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, when you look at that place, he's talking about a 50 or 60 ton agave oven, right?
Is that how big those ovens were that we saw at Jaral de Berrio?
Yes. Is that the name of the hacienda around the corner? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the name of the town that it's in.
Yeah. So that's his estimate. I mean, like, I'd be no good at estimating the size of the ovens, right? But the biggest ovens I've ever seen, and like any one of them is bigger than any operation I've seen, and they have like five of them.
Right.
And you know, and he goes on to talk of and we see this over and over again at the haciendas that we visit in this region between Guanajuato and San Luis Potosí. And at one point he was talking with me about when you're looking at that capacity per oven, And then you think about their ability to transport the agaves, the harvested agaves.
Right. What are they using?
Right.
Animals?
Well, he said each of these haciendas had to have had 500, 600, 700 donkeys just to move the piñas, which, you know, when you think about that capacity, he was estimating that back in the day, just in this region, in fact, I think he even said, and I'll have Future Lou confirm this or deny this.
Yeah, this is Future Lou, and Past Lou, you're just proving yourself to be full of nonsense. I'm not finding that number anywhere in what Juan Pedro said to you. So, go back to your little fiction here, pal.
But I think he even said that just this one hacienda was producing something on the order of 10 million liters a year back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And then, you know, you think about the entire market for mezcal now is 12 to 14 million liters.
It doesn't even seem, it seems like some of the math didn't math right. The numbers are kind of unbelievable.
Well, yes and no, right? So I don't disagree with you, but I think you kind of have to set the numbers aside. And here's why I say this, right? We are never going to know the truth of how much they were producing because there are no record books, right?
Sans time machine. I agree with that.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough. So then you have to look at why in the world would one place have ovens this size? Like when you're talking about, 50 to 60 tons, you're now talking 50,000 to 60,000 kilos. If they were producing spirits at a rate of, let's say 10 kilos, let's go 20 kilos mm-hmm. per liter, right? Which mm-hmm. would be really inefficient. And given that they were working with steam, because we've seen the steam boilers, right?
Yeah.
Probably not inefficient. But even if they were doing it relatively inefficiently at 20 kilos per liter, when you're talking 50,000 kilos in one oven.
Yeah, it's just bananas. Who's drinking all that?
Me. So that's, right? So that alone, just one oven is going to produce 2,500 liters.
Right.
So if you have four or five of them, it suggests to me that you aren't if you only drank 2,500 liters and then made another batch, you only need one oven.
Right.
They needed these ovens, and this is just one hacienda that's Jeez. Surrounded by all these other. My point being this, right, is I think if we could take an agave road trip back in time. Wait a minute. What's that?
Time machine.
Hot tub time machine, but it would be a road trip time machine. If we could take a trip back in time, I think we would be seeing what would look like at scale some significantly relatively pre-industrial mezcal being produced in a way that even today you don't really see outside of a handful of places.
Mm-mm.
So when you think about that, and then you think about 1893 World's Fair, Mexico wants to present. What are we going to present? Well, we got to have some agave spirits. We drink mezcal here. So let's present mezcal. And then there had to have been a conversation about which mezcal. Right?
And why, with all of the way that this math is working, why then does that geographical area, the San Luis Potosí mezcal, get spurned for the tequila?
Right. And that,
is it money?
Well, we will never know, as Juan Pedro says, so many of these facts are lost to us.
Yeah.
But, when I think about, in my forensic sort of way, when I think about what that conversation must have looked like, my head goes to, how close were we to the revolution at that point? Was this trying to overthrow the haciendas and really put more emphasis on the small farmers?
Hmm.
Right.
When was the World's Fair? I'm going to out my weakness in history. When was the World's Fair compared to the Mexican Revolution?
Okay, so the Mexican Revolution is 1918, I think. Is that right? Hang on.
Yeah, that sounds right. So the haciendas are still owned by Spanish royalty, essentially.
Yeah, correct.
So who's in charge of selecting, you know, this process of selecting mezcal or tequila to be representative of Mexico at the World's Fair?
Well, and that's exactly my point, right? Is I gotta believe, hang on a second here, Mexican Revolution, let's check our facts. 1910 to 1920, right. Okay, so I've got to believe that it's not like the Mexican Revolution was just overnight, right? That
no, there were, no, of course. Right. Huge run-up.
Right, right, which is my point, right? So the 1893 World's Fair, right, mm-hmm. is what we're talking about, yeah. which is realistically, you know, maybe two dozen years. No, not even two dozen, 20 years, less than 20 years
right.
from the start of the actual revolution.
There's considerable conflict brewing at that point.
Right. And so who made the decision?
That's what it's got to be. It's got to be a conflict of power.
Right. And was it like somebody trying to fight for the small farmers that are in Jalisco? Was it somebody trying to move the influence of Mexico from that Guanajuato, San Luis Potosí area over to Jalisco? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what it was, but when you think about, we want to introduce something, if you think of it just from a straight business perspective, right? We want to introduce something to the world that speaks to what Mexico is and then sell it to them,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, okay, we've got these haciendas and they're producing 2,500 liter batches pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Seems weird not to choose it.
It seems weird not to choose it. And
but
so,
it could be, if somebody Mexican was in charge of that choice, it could have been like a jab to the fact that the Spanish royalty was in charge of those haciendas.
Yeah.
I don't know at what point Mexico or Mexicans kind of take over the pride of having made those spirits, right? Like when Malena talks about her family,
yeah,
like there's a ton of pride in the fact that her lineage was, I always talk of it like they're the boss at the hacienda. Now they're not in charge, right? The big right. boss is Spain,
right?
But they're in charge of the process, and that's really a point of pride.
Sure.
But when did they start owning that? I don't know if the Spanish were still in charge there when that was feeling like an internal, you know, like a keepsake, like something we're like, we own this, we're good at this. Or if it was after what I call the severance package, Spain leaves and then that's where, you know, the fabrica that we know,
their severance
package is a little piece of land and some yep. of the tools from the process. Cause it's really easy to understand for Americans, you know?
Yeah.
Curious. Okay. Wait, the other thing that is interesting about what you just said is the flip. Did they want to, if Mexico felt more connection, or whoever's in charge, I'm saying Mexico like it's right. an entity, right?
Right.
I'm following this hypothesis that
yeah.
somebody that was not from the Spanish crown, that was from Mexico, indigenous Mexico or whatever, is wanting to represent their country via these smaller farms, and that's why they choose tequila. What a flip. That's exactly backwards
yep.
of the way that the spread is now. Tequila, the industrial, big
yep.
names, right?
Yep.
And all these small rural farms that we talk about and visit.
Yep.
What?
Right. And then you see like this other movement within tequila now, where even it's trying to become the small farm again in some ways. Not, you know, obviously not as an entire industry.
Right.
But you're seeing individual brands. And, you know, and I really do credit David Suro for starting this movement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's been a huge piece of that.
Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For in essence, trying to make it small again in a way that reflects that heritage that, you know, that in essence, the meet the new boss, same as the old boss, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, well, let's make you the new boss again.
It kind of softens my posture towards the tequila mezcal narrative, because what if that is our hypothesis that we're running? What if that is what happened? Therefore, In some small way along the journey,
yep, yep.
the tequila boom and the growth and that was sort of an unintended, not unintended, they did intend that. Mm-hmm. We want to show this to the world and then sell it. But in a way, the big monster mega growth is a bit of an unintended consequence. And now you see the boomerang or the pendulum, like with somebody like David Zuro, who's bringing it back. That could be a match for the original intent.
Right, 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 right. And then at the same time, as Mezcal gets bigger and bigger, I think we're seeing the exact same pattern. Right, exactly.
Swing back the other way.
Yeah, and obviously not with all Mezcal. But you know, it's when I think about what Oaxaca looked like the first time I visited in 2008 and what it looks like to me now, right? And
oh, that's good perspective.
Yeah.
To be able to really like... viscerally feel the growth.
Yeah. And you know, and you see it in both ways. You see the benefits to, I mean, God, when I think about one mescalero whose name I won't use, but when I think about what he looked like when I first met him shortly after he had a stroke, people didn't think he was going to make it. And now he's this healthy guy that looks great. And,
oh, wow.
Right. And then you see these kids who were able to go to college and like, you know, so I'm not suggesting that, oh, it's bad, but I am saying it's different. It's different. And it's following the same pattern of little gets big and then big gets overtaken by little. And then that little gets big. And right. It's this leapfrog thing.
How can that, I'm thinking, wondering, curious about how that can affect the way that we look at growth nowadays. Like something that looks in the short term like a really great decision, perhaps maybe it behooves us to sort of zoom out before making some of those choices and anticipate. I don't know that we'd be good at it. I mean, our brains can do that. We can future cast.
Sure.
We can, you know, and we can plan and so I just wonder if there's something in there that could improve the way we make decisions about the future.
Maybe, but you know, I think the other piece of it is it's really easy to get caught up in, you know, I'm going to say get caught up in the moment of the success as though if you had your mind about you, you wouldn't do these things. But the truth is, maybe you would. You know, like it's really easy to be the guy shaking the fist at the victor because you want to be the underdog. And then when you go from underdog to victor, right, like you kind of feel like this is what you've always been working for. So is it really that wrong?
Well, it's like a paradigm shift. You're in a certain mindset when you're the underdog, and as soon as you're the victor, it's like that goes by the wayside and you establish a new thinking. Maybe that puts you in a better light.
Or do you always feel like the underdog?
Even when you're the victor?
Even when you're the victor, you don't even recognize it. You know, it's funny. Like, this brings me back to my days at Marvel Comics where, you know, I used to run the sales department. And specifically the sales department that dealt with stores who were specialty stores, comic book stores.
Nerdy.
Yeah. Like I had nothing to do with the 7-Elevens and the grocery stores, all that stuff. And they were constantly saying, you need to do mass market advertising, Lou. There needs to be Spider-Man ads on television. I was like, nobody knows who Spider-Man is. Mm. We don't have sales. No, like nobody. And we didn't recognize that we were that successful when we were that successful.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's the difficult part of going from the underdog to the victor is I think you rarely recognize it. Even when, even when it's apparent, you're given the award, you're voted into an office. I'm not going to get too political. I'm going to stop that there. But, you know, you feel like, okay, now the underdogs are in charge. And you don't recognize that when you're in charge, you're not the underdog.
Yeah, there was a shift in there that you missed.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I think if I had to summarize all of this, I'd have to say, well, that's all just theory. But the one theory that we know is actually not a theory, but it's a fact, is that Mezcal Villasuso is owned by the Villasuso family.
You son of a gun.
Yeah.
Charlotte, beginning and end parentheses.
There we go. Okay. Anything else you want to add, Linda?
Nope. That's a fact.
Okay. I'll catch you next episode. Hasta pronto.
See you later.
You've been listening to Agave Road Trip, the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps Gringex bartenders better understand agave, agave spirits, and rural Mexico. We're blessed with sound engineering by Roy Sierra and a theme song performed by Gabriel Oliveira and Marco Ricos. Sign up to become a road tripper and listen to more episodes at agaveroadtrip.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please let us know. And if you hated it, well, I'm sure you'll let us know that too. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Agave Road Trip. Agave Road Trip is a production of 10 Angry Pit Bulls, Inc. Agave Road Trip is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. To subscribe to the Heritage Radio newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with Heritage Radio Network on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find Heritage Radio Network at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization using the power of educational storytelling about food to build a more equitable, resilient food system. Heritage Radio Network couldn't do that without support from listeners like you. Become a part of the world's most innovative community today. Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the Heritage Radio Network family by becoming a member. To become a member of the Heritage Radio Network, click on the beating heart of our homepage. Heritage Radio Network can become addictive. Programming you hear on Heritage Radio Network might lead you to eat, drink, and listen to more programming on Heritage Radio Network. If you drink, please do not drink and drive. Drink responsibly. Drive responsibly. Eat responsibly, too. And listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly. To listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly, wear protective earbuds. While wearing protective earbuds, do not drive. Do not walk either. Sit in a comfortable chair. If that comfortable chair has a hard seat, please remember to stretch every 30 minutes. If you stretch every 30 minutes, please stay within your defined stressing capacity. And consult a doctor who specializes in stretching. If you don't have a doctor, maybe Dr. Ryan Acock, the Cocktail MD, can help you out. Thanks for listening. Agave Road Trip out.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.